This is Stefan Heller, 19 November 1983, Alchemy.
The topic of discussion this evening, being that of alchemy, needs to be considered, first of all, within a very general context of the symbolic life. We need to remember that from the beginning of human history on, there have been employed within the disciplines of spiritual growth and transformation of the human race certain languages of the gods. These languages, as we might call them metaphorically, are the systematizations of symbols which are conducive to the spiritual growth and transformation of the human psyche. It is my conviction, as indeed it would appear that has been to a very large extent the view of Dr. Carl Jung, that all of these symbol systems, without exception, have as their true objective the spiritual transformation of the human psyche. Even though this intention is veiled in various allegories and is camouflaged by way of certain so-called objectives, which, however, in most instances but conceal the authentic objectives beneath or behind the veil. In ancient times, or in the times that preceded the triumph of the Semitic religions in the Mediterranean and in the Western world, these religions being Judaism and its offspring, Christianity, and the subsequent hybrid of both, known as Islam, prior to that time, the languages of the gods, the various symbol systems of transformation proliferated for a considerable period of time, especially from about 500-400 BC until 300 or 400 AD, in a period of almost 1,000 years. This period is often referred to as the Hellenistic period, or sometimes also the Alexandrian period of Mediterranean or Western thought. And Jung, in some of his works, has pointed out, notably in Modern Man in Search of a Soul, that our present era, our 20th century, especially the latter part of the 20th century, bears a remarkable similarity to that supremely exciting and in many ways spiritually creative period in the history of our culture known as the Hellenistic era. Then, as now, the symbolic systems of transformation and of spiritual growth received a great deal of attention. And so it is perhaps not without a good reason that we, this evening here, and no doubt Dr. Jung, quite a number of years ago in Switzerland, by way of his great studies of alchemy, psychology and alchemy, alchemical studies, Mysterium Conjunctionis, and many other essays and references, brought attention to one of these great languages of the gods, one of these great symbol systems, known as alchemy. But there are, of course, others. And it may be useful to make a very, very brief introductory comparison so that we may see alchemy within a certain useful context. When the ancient peoples were desirous of perceiving symbolically their own nature and the path of their own transformation, it would seem that first of all, as the very first effort, although of course we cannot be sure about these things, they looked up into the night sky and there perceive the innumerable shining luminaries of the heavens, known as the stars, the planets and the constellations, the moon and the various other celestial luminaries. And as has been pointed out to us once again in analytical psychology, in the teachings of Jung, they did what we do all the time. They got hold of the most urgently manifesting archetypal powers and potencies within their own nature, and they threw them out onto the sky and perceived them there in a symbolic and quasi-objective manner. And so when they wanted to understand, let us say, their own energetic, passionate, warlike, judgmental, hostile nature, they looked up at the red planet Mars, and there they saw symbolically represented this particular part of their own inner makeup. When they wanted to understand and relate themselves to their feeling nature, their love nature, their passionate sexual nature, they looked up at the morning and evening star, the glorious planet Venus, in her two aspects of morning and evening, of Venus Lucifer and Venus Hesperus, and they saw that side of themselves. And so on and so forth with the restrictive, law-giving, order-imposing character of Saturn, with the quick, trickster-like, communicative, mercantile and thieving character of Mercury, and so on and so forth. And so as time went on, an entire symbol system developed in the sky. And the symbols, there perceived, of course, related themselves to these powers inside of people. And we might say a system of the symbolic understanding of the human psyche developed, known as astrology. But something else also developed. And this other thing is the disguise of astrology, the veil before the face of true astrology. And that is the veil that declares that astrology has to do with the predicting of the future, that it has to do with figuring out what is going to happen tomorrow and the day after, whether we ought to go out because of a particular conjunction, a particular configuration of celestial bodies, whether this man and that woman ought to have anything to do with each other due to their particular horoscopes or horoscopes and so forth. This is the veil before astrology. This is not true astrology. But the authentic astrology was and is a simple system of human transformation. But for thousands of years, the overwhelming majority of people believed that astrology had to do with that great and ignoble attempt of human beings to manipulate life instead of cooperating with life and living life. And of course, no doubt you are aware that the more we try to manipulate life, the less we are able to live it. And from time to time, of course, there came the wise people who pointed out that this was not its proper purpose. And we have such people today. Now, a very similar situation arose, and I will only mention these two systems right now because it serves to tell us the point. A very similar situation existed regarding alchemy. On the way over, the chairman has just told me a little story how his parents were visiting here a short time ago, and apparently the great and terrifying news of this alchemical event was already in the air, sort of hovering over Seattle like a great coming menace, the arrival of the alchemist from the place of evil known as Los Angeles, the city of the fallen angels, where the uh, the fumes, the fumes of the Tartarian regions in the form of smog swirl around, and strange and awesome spirit forms materialize in them, where the spring season can be told by the smog slowly turning green, and various things of that sort. And so his mother asked him, well, isn't alchemy that sort of thing that people were doing in order to turn lead into gold? And I think he answered both with a yes and a no. Well, this image of alchemy has a physical operation wherein the, again, ubiquitous, the ever-present desire of human beings for riches may be satisfied by changing the ordinarily available substances into precious substances. This is the veil in front of the face of alchemy. Even as the manipulative, predictive, personalistic aspects of astrology are the veil before the face of astrology. It took, again, a long period of time from the Renaissance period into the 20th century until someone came forward with a great deal of insight and also a good deal of scholarly research, namely Dr. Jung, who tore once again that veil from the face of alchemy, and who pointed out for our benefit that alchemy is indeed a simple system of human transformation. It is strange that for such a long time prior to the coming of Dr. Jung, this fact was so ignored and concealed. Because if we look at many of the best, the most lucid and most insightful alchemical texts themselves, we find that this discovery of Dr. Jung must indeed have been a rediscovery. For these texts declare it themselves that the alchemist himself must change into the philosopher's stone. Be therefore living philosopher's stones. And it is transparent. The symbolism is quite transparent in most of the great alchemical works, indicating that we are indeed involved here in a system that deals not with the external material transformation, but rather the interior spiritual psychic transformation of human beings. But of course, like all symbol systems, the process needs its particular expressions. The inner processes, the inner powers need to be focused upon, projected upon, some kind of a symbolic modality. And the symbolic modality of alchemy is indeed the world around us with its terrestrial substances, with its chemicals, with its stones, with its gems, with its metals, with its elements. And really the system of alchemy in that sense survived for our benefit quite without the amount of difficulty and persecution that so many of the other symbol systems did, precisely for this reason. For our culture, our civilization was slowly already during the Middle Ages and the Renaissance moving in a materialistic direction. And therefore, the symbols of matter themselves appeared as an instrumentality singularly well fitted for the projection of these spiritual realities and their simultaneous concealment. The veil before alchemy, the idea of making gold, the idea of which is not really true, you know, strictly speaking. The alchemists did not wish to make gold, even outwardly speaking. What they said was that they would produce the stone of the philosophers and the elixir of life, and that these substances, particularly the stone, the lapis philosophorum, would have the power to change ignoble substances into gold. So that the stone has to be produced, and the stone makes the change, not the alchemist. Nevertheless, in its practical promise, a promise hardly ever fulfilled physically, I understand, the idea was there that gold could be made, riches could be produced. And this in turn aroused the interest and afforded the protection and the help of those powerful individuals and groups in the world who already have gold and who therefore want more. That it was that way then, it is that way now. And so they subsidized the alchemists. What in those days passed for the government grants and the corporate grants started flowing into the alchemists' hands. And the alchemists, even as modern academicians, hardly ever refuse. They said, oh yes, give it to us. We'll do something with it, all right? And they did, whether gold was produced or not. And so this entire symbol system, which was not intended purely as a camouflage to begin with, did come in quite handy. It helped. Now, so much about the original background. Incidentally, the name alchemy comes from the Arabic. Al-A-L is the article D-H-E, the pronoun describing something, and Chem is the ancient word for Egypt. And so, inasmuch as the symbol system of alchemy was associated with ancient Egypt, at least in Hellenistic times, alchemy was already practiced in Alexandria and places like that. When the Muslim Arab conquerors came to Egypt and various other Near Eastern lands, they started referring to alchemy as that Egyptian thing, the Egyptian science. And so the word alchemy came into existence. But of course, what we are all much more interested in, I think, right now, than these historical circumstances, is the actual work, the actual process of alchemy itself, and how it relates to our own inner natures, to the transformation of our own being. One more little fact needs to be mentioned. It's a big fact, but we'll make it short, that relates to this matter very vitally. It must be stated, and has been stated accurately, that in its own way, all of religion, all of the religious activities of people are involved in the process of human transformation. Religions on the whole originate in the innate recognition, even though sometimes unconscious recognition of people, that growth, transformation, deification of the human soul, the coming of a much greater level of wholeness than we possess at the present time is possible, and indeed that we must do something about bringing this possibility into reality in our lives. But history proceeds, the majority of the religious efforts inevitably tend to devolve into what has been called popular or folk religiosity. In this popular or folk religiosity, the transformational element exists, but at a very low level. It is a very low-key transformation. The emphasis is far more upon aspects of religiosity which are conducive to, what might be called psychological law and order in society. Religion comes and tells people, you must do such and such, which is uncomfortable enough sometimes, but the other part is far worse. It tells us an awful lot of things that we ought not to do. I think it was Lord Bertrand Russell, the Earl of Russell, the great philosopher, who said that Christianity is a don't religion. Judaism is a do religion. And some of the Eastern religions are be religions. In other words, the element of prohibition is so extremely important. And then on the other hand, of course, we have all kinds of things to believe in, and thereby we will achieve a certain degree of security. But now what we must remember is that always in the history of humankind, from the earliest times that we can study, clear back in the Neolithic period, in very, very primitive peoples, there seem to have been side by side with this kind of rigid, constructive, conservative, law and order oriented spirituality, there was always another one. And this other one was always weird and wild and peculiar and, of course, far more exciting than the other. The dancing shamans with the horns on their heads, the witches prancing around at Halloween and other times with their magic broomsticks, all of these things, they were all part of that other, that alternative spirituality. And this alternative spirituality came to bring into existence the great mystery systems in Greece, Eleusis, the Orphic mysteries. In Egypt, the mysteries of Isis and Osiris and others, and so forth. And all of these were schools of transformation. They were not concerned with how people ought to behave. They were not concerned with what their sex lives were, what they ate, what they drank, whether they spoke politely to each other, whether they cussed at each other, and things of that sort. They were concerned with how they could change, how they could unleash the locked up great potential of ineffable greatness within themselves. And among these developments, in the period that I indicated before, in the Alexandrian period, particularly between about the year, between the 1st and 3rd and 4th century AD, namely after the beginning of the Christian era, there was also a group of people in the Mediterranean area, but spread all over the Roman Empire, who came to be known as Gnostics. Gnosticoi, those people who know. What did these fellows and these ladies know? They knew what we students of Dr. Jung are trying to know, namely, that we are really more than we appear, and that this essential being of ourselves, a wholeness, a fullness, must be made manifest. They also knew something else, and this is where, of course, the great similarity between Dr. Jung's teachings and these ancient Gnostics comes into the picture. They knew that this ineffable greatness or wholeness can only come into existence, into being, by way of a reconciliation and a union of the opposites. In other words, that true spiritual growth is not achieved by just going ahead in a linear fashion in one direction. We say, we are bad, we are going to become good. We are little, we are going to become big, larger. We are stupid, we are going to become wise. And so we go in one line in a certain direction. That's really the way most people envision growth. But these old people, like Dr. Jung later on, said that the objective is wholeness, totality. That the trouble with us is not that we are not good enough, not nice enough, not wise enough, not moral enough. Well, all of those things might also be involved. The world is full of stupid people, the world is full of immoral people, the world is full of all kinds of balderdash. But these are more in the nature of symptoms than in the nature of the authentic trouble. The true trouble is that people are not whole. They are fragmented. They are divided. And when this wholeness can be reestablished, then we will have the manifestation of the true potential of the human being. The Gnostic Gospels, which have been recently discovered, and with the publication of which, the translation of which Dr. Jung was so closely associated, far more closely than most people know, because the academicians have hogged the glory, but Dr. Jung had a great deal to do with it. Say, as the Gospel of Thomas does, for instance, Jesus is made to declare, "I have come so that the two might be made into the one, the inner and the outer, the above and the below, the male and the female, shall be made into a single one." Now, these people, these Gnosticoi, who had brought together innumerable elements from all kinds of traditions, Egyptian, Babylonian, Roman, Greek, Jewish, Christian, in order to illustrate and amplify the process of transformation, had passed out of the picture because of persecution, because of certain changes in the religious scene in the 3rd century. And now the great question arose, how will this effort toward wholeness, this process that has begun in such a promising manner, this alternative spirituality, survive? And Dr. Jung was the first one. Now there are many people who agree with him who pointed out that it survived chiefly by way of alchemy. Dr. Jung even pinpointed a particular individual who was, we might say, the great translator or the great creator of the camouflage, the great playwright who wrote the scenario of disguise for the ancient Gnosis. And that he was a Byzantine Greek philosopher by the name of Zosimos of Panopolis. But whichever the case may be, alchemy made its appearance and its reappearance all over Europe. And here, veiled and illustrated in this entirely different terminology, not as a religion or not anything that looked like a religion, not like anything that could challenge the established religious authorities, something that the inquisitors wouldn't worry about. Here the old art, the old process of transformation flourished, illustrated by its own allegories and veiled in its own symbols. Now, what were these symbols primarily, and how do they relate to our transformation? We'll have to take a very quick and a very quintessential, to use an alchemical term, look at these in order to have an overview of the situation and perhaps to enable those of us who wish to pursue these matters further to do an informed study by way of reading and so forth. The alchemist, the entire alchemical proposition is really based on this. That the world with its elements exists in a certain way. There is a certain given world in which we find ourselves. The alchemist said this is the world of the four elements: earth, water, fire, and air. This is a very, very old system. It probably has existed again since the beginning of the human race. The four elements, which of course now modern science has discarded in favor of the table of the elements and so forth, not recognizing that these old four elements of earth, water, fire, and air were primarily of symbolical nature. They were psychological elements, even though they came to be perceived in the physical universe. Nowadays, especially in analytical psychology, we would, I think, rather readily identify them with, or at least relate them to by way of an analogy, the four functions of the ego, the four functions of consciousness: earth, sensation; water, feeling; thinking, probably either to air or to fire; and similarly, intuition to one of these two. So what did the alchemists say? They said, here we are, we are born into this world as little babies, we grow up, we become adults, and we look around and we find ourselves in a fourfold world. The earth, water, fire, air relate themselves to each other in a certain way. It's all functioning in a certain fashion. Now we have a choice, a great choice. We can either adjust, accommodate ourselves to this fourfold world, and try to make the best of it. If we do that, we will change perhaps very, very slowly. We will grow perhaps, but in a very, very minuscule fashion. Because they said everything in that world is subject to a very slow, almost imperceptible process of growth and transformation. They said, for instance, that all the various pebbles and stones and dirt and pieces of carbon and so forth in the earth is slowly trying to change into precious gems. If we give enough, long enough period of time, enough millions of years, then all of these little pieces of junk around us will develop into diamonds, emeralds, and rubies and things of that sort. But they also said, rather wisely, do we want to wait for that? Can we wait for that? Or maybe we could do something just a little bit more expeditious about the situation. And here they said, now, if you don't want to adjust, if you don't want to go along with the world as you find it, if you think that something more could be done, then become an alchemist. When you become an alchemist, you study the writings of the alchemists, you learn the system, you are apprenticed to the right masters, then you can begin doing something that this world in which you are of its own is incapable of accomplishing. Zoe Oldenburg, that wonderful French, well, she's really of an immigrant Russian family, but French novelist and historian, the great medievalist, perhaps some of you have read her books, has one wonderful book about the Crusades. The book is entitled, The World Is Not Enough. The World Is Not Enough. And this could be called really the motto of the alchemists. To the alchemists, the world was not enough. And they would venture to suggest, if you care to agree with me, and if you don't care to agree with me, I still suggest it, this is to a very large extent the difference between those of us who are attached, let us say, to the reality model and the model of the psyche that Dr. Carl Jung has brought to our attention, and on the other hand, those people who are attached to other models, the models of the behaviorists, with their lovely little rats, and all that sort of thing. These amazed rats who run around in mazes. And all that, what the late Arthur Koestler of blessed memory called ratomorphism. You know, there was a time when we had anthropomorphic religion, now we have ratomorphic psychology. And you know what? It rules the psychology department in every bloody university in this bloody country. Why? I don't know, but there must be something about rats. There just must be something about rats. But even if we come closer to our family, to our, our grand uncle, whom we don't like to acknowledge very often because his cigars didn't smell all that good, namely Uncle Siggy Freud from Vienna. He was a very great man and he did wonderful things, but when it comes right down to it, ultimately, he and especially his disciples and his followers are also among the people who say the world has to be enough. You have to adjust to the world. If you don't adjust to this world, then you are not only everybody's neurotic, but then you are not only neurotic, but you are a bad neurotic. A bad neurotic. One who receives the opprobrium, the condemnation of the Freudian Jehovah's. You know, who stand in front of their couches holding up the stone tablets of Sigmund Freud and whack people over the head and call them bad neurotics, you know. And really, Now I'm really beginning to step on toes, but that has never bothered me in the past. I don't think I'm going to start worrying about it now. Even when you come to the lovely, nice people, humanistic psychologists, whatever that is supposed to be. Well, it's not rhetoromorphic, at least, you know. It's humanomorphic, whatever, you know, anthropomorphic. And human potential movement, transpersonal psychology, all that sort of thing. Wonderful things. But when you look at it, again, the world is enough for these people in a certain level. They have expanded their world, yes. They have expanded it into regions even that don't exist. but not even by the wildest stretch of active imagination. but the trust is still... But everything is so wonderful and so glorious, this divinely diffused tapioca pudding. You know, just embrace the world and grin and be happy. Just nice, lovely, wonderful, love, and all that sort of thing. It is still essentially an adjustment cycle. Maybe I'm prejudiced, but then maybe that's why I'm here, because I feel that I'm among the members of my family who have a very similar dedication and orientation. I think only one man among all of these people, past and present, deserves to be called the true alchemist of the soul, and that is Carl Gustav Jung. Why? Because he said, the darkness and the light, the black phase of alchemy, the white phase of alchemy, the king and the queen, the devil and God, the material world and the spiritual world have to be united in order to bring something new along. And in order to do that, we have to, and we can, and we must, really turn away from the world as we find it and recreate our own world. A true work of alchemy. That is exactly what the alchemist said. The alchemist said, now, we need to turn around the entire world in order to bring something new into existence. We have to first destroy the world as it is. Now, not the external world necessarily, although that is destroyed from time to time too, especially on television like last night. but our own ego world, we have to alter it radically. Reduce it to a condition where it really can transform, so that the objective becomes not just a linear growth, but an essential transformation. And so the alchemist first employed various processes which altered the shape and the contour of the physical elements completely, reduced them to a turgid mass, so that you could no longer distinguish the fire and the air and the earth and the water, and everything has become a strange, mysterious, dark mass. The primal confusion, so the order that we find has been reduced to confusion. And only out of this confusion, which is the prima materia, the original matter, can the new world, the new philosopher's stone grow. And this is the alchemists considered this a horrific process, because when they saw in front of them the elements disappear, the world disappear, they themselves felt as if they were disappearing. They were losing their ego, they were losing their hold on things. Rationality, and there was rationality in those days just as much as now, only it appeared different. Even as what we call now rational will appear as complete insanity a few hundred years from now, probably for the very good reason that it is. Paracelsus said that reason, rationalism, is the greatest unreason. That people who are desperately trying to be rational and rationalistic are all insane. They are trying to worship something that cannot hold its own because of it is incomplete. In any event, we are We are therefore coming to a recognition in alchemy that our world view of the way we see the world has to be altered. That we have to undo before we can do. We have to undo reason, we have to undo the ordinary logical order of things and really reduce ourselves to a condition of primeval creative innocence before the new can come into existence. If we don't recognize that and draw the conclusions from that, spiritual growth or real transformation becomes an impossibility. But of course, this is the precise aspect of alchemy or spiritual transformation against which most people have the greatest resentment, the greatest resistance. Why? We all would like to grow, but we would like to essentially keep what we have and what we are. We would like to merely become more of what we are. But that, you see, is precisely not the point. You are not supposed to become more of what you are. You are supposed to become essentially different from what you are. You are supposed to become a new being, not an old being slightly dressed up, slightly powdered, with a new set of makeup, or something of that sort, a new mask. And therefore, now we go further in the process. When this prima materia, this primeval chaos, has been produced in the alchemical retort, which is of course our own psyche, now certain new polarities begin to arise. Now on the new stage, to which now our condition has been reduced, there appear the real protagonists and antagonists, the real actors of the great drama. So, you know, once again, I don't want to belabor the point, but this should prove to us that the way reality looks to us initially is not the true reality. What we think goes on in this world is not what goes on. What we think the problem is not the problem. We might think that the problem is that we are not happy, that we are not adjusted, that our wives, our husbands, I use them in the plural because we live in a culture of serial polygamy and polyandry, as you very well know, and so forth, leave us and go away, and that we suffer from these things, or we think that the problem is that some people have missiles that are going to blow up the world. After all, the great Jehovah, the television tube, told us so. ABC, CBS, all of these things, they told us it must be so. The great revelation. I mean, here's the new Mount Sinai, you know, the television tube. There it is, thundering at us, Armageddon, so forth. We think that those are the problems, but those are not the problems. And so we have to get away from these problems. We have to reduce them to the essential background. And then out of this background, the real issue begins to emerge. So if you just want to go on fighting the issues of this world and the issues of your life, manipulating circumstances around, trying to juggle around what your parents told you, what your Sunday school told you, what society tells you, the television tells you and the newspapers and this, that, and the other thing, then you are just dealing with the world of the four elements. The time must come where you turn your back on all of this. Well, not necessarily in an outward manner. You still have to observe the traffic signs, and you still have to observe certain essential laws. One cannot do a very successful alchemy in jail. And as I understand, I stayed out of it so far, but for the grace of Abraxas, for the grace of the Gnostic gods, I could have been there any time, and so forth. So we are not talking about an outwardly anarchistic or revolutionary behavior, but inward. The values, the moralities, the rules, the laws, these are all okay at their own level, but they are not going to help you transform it. You have to find something new. The greatest treasures bequeathed to you by your parents, by your society, by your religion, are utterly and completely and hopelessly useless Why? Because they are not yours. They have not come out of yourself. They have not come out of your ritual. They have been produced by another alchemist or a set of alchemists long ago and far away. And therefore you have to find your own. You might say, but who am I? I'm stupid. I am uninformed. I am unenlightened. How can I produce something that equals Moses or Jesus or Zarathustra? Well, nobody said that you ought to produce something that will equal that. You have to produce something that will be useful to you, that will serve the purpose of your own alchemy. And if you pardon the expression, to heck with all of these people. And you might even add the double L at the end of that heck, in that sense. And this is not a condemnation of any master or any authority. It is merely the indication that you are the alchemist and you have to do the work yourself. And when you have thus reduced the circumstances which were given to you to that massa confusa, that primeval material, the prima materia, then within this there arise the two new opponents, which relate themselves to each other. The alchemists called them salt and sulfur. Salt was envisioned as feminine and receptive and having to do with the feelings and the mood. And sulfur was envisioned as being masculine and energetic and fiery, but at the same time also always until untransmuted producing destruction. A conserving element, the salt, and a revolutionary element, the sulfur. And so within these two, they conceived of all the polarities of existence. Masculine, feminine, conservative and progressive, or revolutionary, you name it. Conscious and unconscious, inner and outer, moral and immoral. You can go on and on. All the polarities are there. And now these polarities begin to interact with each other. But in order to accomplish a true interaction and eventually a union, a third factor is needed. A third factor. And this third factor was symbolized in alchemy by Mercury, or the spirit of Mercury, as it is called. This was looked upon as the medium of the conjunction, the instrumentality of transformation. The exciting transforming agency that comes forth from the archetypal unconscious, from the archetypal psyche, the objective psyche, the collective unconscious. And so it was not without a good reason that Mercury was chosen for that, which is related to the ancient god Mercury, the messenger of the gods, the thief, the one who unites the opposites, the stimulator of the transformation, the merchant who exchanges the activity, the god with the sandals on his feet and on his helmet. And so with his aid, by way of his stimulation, as he constantly goads the two parties on, as he helps once the salt and another time the sulfur, the two begin to interact with each other and go through a large number of stages of transformation. So that we are still only really talking about a very early phase of the situation. And now really the great process begins. So what I spoke about so far were the preliminary stages, the reducing of the existing world to the prima materia and the arising of the new, of the three forces that they are called. Now comes the actual stage. This, I will quickly go through some of these. There are certain grade divisions. The big stages are the so-called black stage, the white stage, and the red stage. Sometimes a stage or phase called the yellow stage is inserted. The black stage is the one that follows upon the preparation, and it is a pretty difficult and dark condition. It is a condition within which there is much danger, much sorrow, very little clarity of meaning, and a great deal of defeat, the defeat of consciousness. So you can see now, by way of this alchemical analogy, why we are attached to some of the formulations of Dr. Jung are so often accused of being gloomy and depressed and depressing people. Because we tend to give recognition to this factor of darkness. It is, of course, very important with this kind of an understanding to have a good sense of humor and to exercise it whenever possible. You know, you are in this predicament, you are in this mess, and you might as well laugh about it. It's a lot more pleasant than crying about it. You get through it much more easily that way. But in any event, it needs to be recognized as, particularly in the early phases, there is a great deal of difficulty. There are preliminary conjunctions. The opposites try to unite, but they don't make it. They achieve a temporary union, and out of this temporary union comes further trouble, further death. There is first the so-called separation, sometimes also called putrefaction, in the initial phases, sub-phases of the black stage, when the elements, or rather the forces, such as the two, the salt and the sulfur, the king and the queen, as they are often called, the sun and the moon, separate. So now they are facing each other. Then the next one is the initial conjunction, often called by its sexual name, coitus. But that in turn is followed by what is called mortification or death. That in turn is followed by the ablution or the baptism of the dead. And then the black phase is over. It ends with death and the washing of the dead, so to say. And then the white phase arises, within which now the so-called dead person, the dead offspring, the aborted offspring of the king and the queen, comes to life again, and now the philosopher's stone begins to form and grow. Still has a number of phases to go through, but very soon it enters the red stage and it becomes the great final mystery of the new being, which is more than the two opposites had been. What are we really dealing with? In the Greek drama, and Dr. Edward Edinger, in some of his writings, I don't know whether it's in Ego and Archetype, which is a splendid book, but maybe in some other work of his and some other essay of his, brought attention to this, not that others have not, that there is an interesting correlation of these alchemical phases, at least in the black stage and leading up to the white stage, and the four great steps or phases of the Greek drama. In the Greek drama, as brought forth by Aeschylus and Euripides and people like that, there are certain steps. And the first of these is called in Greek agone, which means the contest, the fight. This correlates to a large extent with the initial separatio of the black stage. The two protagonists, antagonists, who are lovers and fighters at the same time. Is that a familiar analogy? I'm sure it is. Come forth and begin to relate, begin to struggle. Then comes the condition, the state of the initial conjunction, and then the defeat, the death. This defeat is called pathos in the Greek drama. And it means that the hero is defeated. Dies. That's why it's a drama. That's why it's a tragedy. They fought, and now they die. The death has occurred. And this, of course, means that before we can triumph, before the true self can triumph, before the philosopher's stone arises, we have to have our defeats. We indeed have to have our deaths. So this includes the symbolism of death and rebirth. You see, the utter stupidity of our culture and of our religion, for that matter, is patently evident in the way, for instance, that we tend to celebrate Easter these days. everything goes along sort of nicely. I'm talking about the mainstream kind of bland tapioca pudding churches, you know. So everything kind of goes along, and all of a sudden here is Easter morning, and the bells are ringing, and the preachers are hooting and hollering, and the choir is preaching, and there are Easter lilies all over the place, and everything. Oh, he's risen. And you say, who? Why? How come? All this sort of thing. You didn't tell us that he died. You know? As far as we are known, nothing happened. We went to the grocery store, and we went to the movies, and all of a sudden he has risen. What did he rise from? What happened? Well, of course, in the original system, of course, there was the whole setup. Starting with Palm Sunday, and then going through Monday, Thursday, and then on Good Friday he dies, then goes down into the underworld, and on Sunday he rises. That really makes sense. But you see, now we want to have resurrections without death. We want to have constant victories without defeat. We want to have one high after the other without a low. How in the heck can you do it? It can't be done. It can't be done. So this is the kind of babyish wishful thinking that exists in our culture that forever just tries to grab hold of the candy and neglects the entire meal. Now, of course, you get all of my friends, the health freaks and so forth, the sprout destroyers, the tumbleweed busters, and they've even done away with the candy. So you see, now we have nothing. We have neither defeat nor victory. We have neither the main course nor the dessert. All we have is unpalatable sprouts. Heaven save us from dessert. Well, but you know, on the other hand, please, if you really like that sort of stuff, don't let me stand in your way. It's all right. Just as long as you don't make me drink it or eat it. I have never demonstrated in front of a health food store yet. So don't take it all too literal. But after all, we have to kick somebody. We only gently push the Freudians. We only give a slight insult to the rhetoromorphists and everything else. Bear with me. A little bit of hostility has to be expressed here. Just has to. But of course, all these things up to is that there has to be defeat, there has to be death. But not only that. The Greeks were smarter than that. Then the next stage, which in our alchemical transformation is really symbolized by the ablutio, or the washing of the seemingly dead body, is what the Greeks in the structure of the tragedy called trenos, lamentation. And many of you have perhaps had some contact or the other with the reenactments of the old tragedy. This is the time where the chorus comes in. And when everybody cries and laments over the hero, and they walk around and express their grief. So what does that mean? It means that the defeat has to be acknowledged. The darkness...